Blog Talk Radio.
Radio's A Date with Destiny for Monday, February the 24th, 2014. I'm your host, Lisa M. Saunders, coming to you live from Baltimore, Maryland. This broadcast is being sponsored by the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum, Incorporated, America's first Black History Wax Museum. And we are super excited about our show this evening. In honor of Black History Month, sharing with us this evening is the founder and CEO of the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum, Dr. Joanne Mitchell Martin, who will be sharing with us her dream realized. To receive this broadcast as a podcast, go to the iTunes Store, click on podcast, and type in A Date with Destiny. Also, follow us on Twitter at least. That's LYSE101, LYSE101. You can also send me a message through this site if you would like to become a sponsor or to get more exposure for your literary work or business. You can send a message through my Facebook page, facebook.com/adatewithdestiny101, or you can leave a message via my website, which is info@yourdestinyawaits.net. So before I introduce tonight's guest, I want to give a shout-out to one of the loves of my life, my grandmother, who turned 90 years young today. So happy birthday, Nanny. I love, love, love you, and I can't wait to see you. So getting into our introduction and for tonight's show, I want to give you a bit of history before I bring in our guest. The National Great Blacks in Wax Museum is among the United States' most dynamic cultural and educational institutions. This unique museum, the first one of wax in Baltimore, Maryland, and the first wax museum of African American history in the nation, is the brainchild of the late Dr. Elmer P. Martin and Joanne Mitchell Martin. They established the museum in 1983 with several objectives in mind. One, to stimulate an interest in African American history by revealing the little-known, often neglected facts of history. Two, to use great leaders as role models to motivate youth to achieve. And three, to improve race relations by dispelling myths of being racially inferior. And four, to support and work in conjunction with other nonprofit charitable organizations seeking to improve the social and economic status of African Americans. As the founders of the National Great Blacks in Wax Museum, Dr. Elmer and Dr. Joanne Martin knew the importance of having a dream and the gratification of having one's dream fulfilled. Their dream took form in 1980 when they, with the money they had, saved to make a down payment on a house, purchased four wax figures. They carried the figures around to schools, churches, shopping malls, and almost anywhere that people would follow them to set up an exhibit. Little did they know that by 1983, they would have a small storefront museum in downtown Baltimore, 21 wax figures, and the good wishes and support of many loyal friends. Our mission on A Date with Destiny is to inspire, motivate, and empower people to move forward in their lives with hope and realizing that they can make their dreams a reality. Our guest this evening is the model for having a dream manifest. So without further ado, we would now welcome Dr. Joanne Mitchell-Martin to A Date with Destiny. Hello, Dr. Martin.
Hello, Lisa Saunders, and thank you so much for having me on your show.
Well, we welcome you to A Date with Destiny. And I just first, before we get going, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time, because I know that this is your busiest time of the year.
Yes, it is. February and this time of year is extremely busy for us. Our busiest month of the year is July, because we do so well with the tourists that come into the area, and most of our visitors are from out of state. So, yes, mm-hmm. But this is a very busy time.
This is a very busy time. So we have so much ground to cover, and I just want to kind of jump right in. I had such a great time developing this particular show because I have a vested interest in the museum. I had the good fortune of working with Dr. Martin, whom I affectionately call Dr. J. There is not enough time in this segment to express what I gained from your tutelage and the love and respect that I have for you and the legacy that you and your late husband have created. So, Dr. Martin, I may have to bring you back on at a later date just so we can fit it all in. Especially when the expansion is finished, which we will get into, talk about that a little bit during this segment too. So let's just start from the beginning, because you know how much I love to hear you tell the story on how it all began. And then me reading it to the listeners doesn't even begin to do your story justice. So I want you to share with our listening audience just how Dr. Elmer had arrived at this vision.
Well, and that is the starting point, an understanding of Dr. Elmer Martin. He was very much a product of his time. We're talking mid-60s, early 70s, the black consciousness, black power, civil rights era in the United States. And Elmer, very much the activist. I can picture him with the big afro and the raised fist and all of those things that represented our generation. And being the activist that he was, he sponsored a Little League baseball team of inner-city kids. He had ID pictures taken of the kids from Baltimore City, and he handed out the pictures. And one of the little kids, a 6, 7, 8-year-old, somewhere in that age range, came up to him demanding that Elmer make the photographer take the picture over. And so Elmer said he just automatically reached out, took the picture, said, "Son, it's a great picture of you. Why do you want him to take it over?" And the kid said, "Because they got me too black in this picture. I don't want to be as black as they got me in this picture." And we were already grappling with the idea that our college-age students, Elmer, a professor at Morgan State University, and me on the faculty of Cobb and State College here in Baltimore, we had a generation of college students who, the really one generation under us that had decided that career-wise, learning black history and culture would be of no value. It wouldn't get you the American dream or the corporate dream or the middle-class dream or whatever the dream might be. And so here they had decided that career-wise it's possible to be too black. And then we've got this kid thinking that physically it's possible to be too black. And we thought when we used slogans that we were, when we said we were black and beautiful and black and proud, or even when we took the name black, because this ours was the generation that determined that we were given the name Negro and colored. We mm-hmm. took a name that represented who we were and what we saw as the direction that our generation would take and future generations would take in declaring that we were black and affirming our blackness and our pride in that. And so to have this kid say, "I don't want to be as black as they got me in this picture," was just a step back, and it meant that Elmer said he sat in his office in between teaching his classes at Morgan saying, "How did we get back to this point, and how did we get back to this point so quickly?" And he said at the end of this thinking, this very painful process of thinking about this, he concluded that we failed to institutionalize our history, to build institutions designed solely for the purpose of preserving the history and culture, and failing that, every generation was going to have to start from scratch. So sort of out of that eventually came the Great Blacks in Wax Museum.
Now, Dr. Martin, again, tell us when, about around the time, the year, this was in the early 70s?
This was in the early 70s when, in fact, it was the early 80s. It was the early 70s when Elmer and members of our generation were embracing the idea of being black, stating for the first time that we were going to choose a name that represented us, not to have a name thrust upon us. Because we've been given the names Negro and colored and slave and all of those things. But to affirm that we were black, I consider that to be a revolutionary act. And so it was out of that kind of philosophy and thinking that Elmer evolved. And he developed a number of ideas out of that time that really guide the museum today.
Right, right. And if, ladies and gentlemen, if you have not visited the museum, it's a must-do. And if you have young children, you need to take your children. And we're not just talking about black people or white people. We're talking about all races. All races need to go and visit this museum. It is just, you know, amazing. It comes alive as soon as you walk through the door. You have exhibits on both sides, and it's just really, really awesome. And if you're lucky and blessed, you may just get a tour by Dr. Martin herself. So you need to go on. And they have a beautiful website, you know, so, you know, Google that, go online and check that out. But so, okay, so then we have Dr. Martin. He came up with the idea, you know, he got inspired by this little boy. So then from that point on, when did the museum take form? When did that take shape?
Well, you know, at that point we were trying to figure out, you know, how do we counter this? We had gone to France 1 year and Spain 1 year, and looking at just the pride that the French people and the Spanish people had in the sense of self, and Elmer said, you know, perhaps having a sense of your place in history, which is something that was denied us as African Americans, having a sense of our place in history, and so we started thinking about, well, what can we do? We wrote some books, but we knew that we needed something that would reach the masses of people, and that would a visual representation that for me puts a face on history. So we started. Elmer started doing research. He found that there was no. We went to a wax museum in Florida, in Potter's Wax Museum in St. Augustine, and got very, very interested in that whole medium as a way of telling the history. We started researching and found that there was no Black History Wax Museum anywhere in the nation, and we said, okay, if it's not in this country, there's probably none any place. And so we just started calling around and learned that there was a wax figure maker in Baltimore. And we contacted him, and he purchased four wax figures from him, and we took out a layaway plan because we had no money, and when we get a little money,
we're
going
to get to that story too. Go ahead.
Okay, and so we bought the figures and started taking them around as a traveling exhibit. And it's interesting that the traveling exhibit is still very much a part of who we are.
Yeah.
But and we started just gathering stuff in the guest bedroom of our two bedroom apartment. We throw the figures into my Pontiac and set them up in a church, a school, a shopping mall, as you read, and then take them home with us to our two bedroom apartment. And we just started accumulating. Elmer started accumulating so much stuff that we, after a while, we couldn't even open the door of that room. We just have to kind of open it as far as we could and pitch things in. And so led to our storefront in downtown Baltimore.
Now, what four figures did you start off with?
Mary McLeod Bethune, Frederick Douglass, John Brown, and Nat Turner.
Annette Turner. Okay, and then expound from there. But, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I was hoping that you would jump into the part where, and they, you've got to tell this one, about the hatchback and getting pulled over. With, so I'll let you go on and tell
well,
that part.
I mean, so many unusual things happen to us. As a traveling exhibit, I'm going to go in and set the exhibit up for some organization. And when he went back to pick it up, and he was tired, and so he just kind of threw Frederick Douglass into the hatchback of my car. Ordinarily, we would have broken the figure down and put it in its case and all of that, in its box. But he just threw it into the hatchback of my car. And for people who did. You have a young audience, I'm sure, and they don't know what I'm talking about with hatchback. But if you think, what is it?
Like a station wagon type of
station
car,
wagon,
right?
That's what I'm trying to think of, yes. And so it's hanging out, and he gets on the beltway of all places. And so the policeman is behind him and not believing he's seeing what he's seeing, and he pulls Elmer over and asked him, what is that? And Elmer's trying to explain that it's a wax figure, and he's not getting that point. And finally he says, look, man, if you're going to put these things in a car, and stay off the beltway. And if you're on the beltway, cover those things up. So anyway, he let Elmer off with a warning, thank goodness, and didn't take him to the pokey for killing Frederick Douglass
exactly,
or whatever he thought it happened.
Exactly, I can't even imagine, riding around and seeing these legs. And this is how real these things look. I mean, so, you know, you can only imagine. But one of the other things, too, Dr. Martin, is that I want my listening audience, you know, one of the things I was looking forward to in you sharing with us this evening is because people they have dreams, and sometimes they often give up on their dream because it becomes too difficult or it takes too long. And they see people like yourself who are very successful, but they don't see your struggle. They don't see the struggle and the goings-on behind the scenes of what it takes to make things happen. I mean, all of this did not just happen overnight. You know, so I want you to talk about the part where, because I'm bringing it up to the present, but I want people to get a sense of what it took in order for you to get even to the point where you are right now. So I want you to kind of share with us another one of my favorite stories, The Ring.
Right. Well, you know, Elmer and I, we always understood that this wasn't about Elmer and Joanne Martin, that it had to be about our youth, about giving them a sense of it. Like, well, you know, that they would never, we would never have children who said, I don't want to be as black as they've got me in this picture.
Right.
And that when I have kids who ask me, why did they make us slaves, I know that they are saying to me, what fatal flaw is there in us that made us the ones that they chose to make slaves? And so to be able to make sure that kids have a sense of pride, a sense of accomplishment, and all of those things, and so whatever sacrifices we've made, readily do them again. And the for the ring story, that we had taken all of our money, we didn't realize that come September the tourists go away, because we opened up on July 9th, 1983, and did very well that summer. And then in September, schools start up again, and so the schools have to get, organized again to do field trips, and the tourists are gone from Baltimore City, and we were struggling. And, you know, sometimes paying our rent here and then trying to figure out how are we going to pay the rent on our storefront. And it got to a point where we had no more money. And Elmer started going around one morning. He finally admitted that he was concerned about the whole financial situation with the museum and paying our rent. And he was running around gathering up our wedding gifts. And things that we'd had for a while, because we'd been married maybe about 5 years, and, you know, you get 8 toasters or whatever. And so then we headed down to a very interesting neighborhood, and I just followed him out to the car and headed off with him. And there we were now at a pawn shop in a neighborhood where there were a string of pawn shops on the street. So I figured out, well, this is where he's going. And he left me in the car, told me to lock the door. And I'm saying, now, what's out there in that world that he wants me to lock myself in from?
Right.
And he went into the pawn shop, and he came back a few minutes later, and he said they don't want any of these things. That what sells for them are guns and rings. And it, the word kind of hung on ring, and I realized that he was asking me to give up my ring, and I saw such a pained look on his face where the last thing in the world he wanted was to take away or ask me to give up this symbol of his love for me. But at the same time, that's where we were, and I didn't want him to feel that way. So I'm pulling off the ring, and it doesn't want to come off, and I'm saying eventually, look, Elmer, we have to do what we have to do. This is a commitment we've made, and he said, Joe, I promise you I'm going to get the ring back. And he came home the next day, put a calendar up on our wall, and every morning before he did anything else, he'd mark the day off because we had 28 days, really, to get the ring back.
Mm-hmm.
And he came into my space at Coppin where I worked, and near day number 28, he walked up to me. My students were looking at all of this. He took my hand, took my finger, slipped the ring back on, and kissed the ring and said, and don't you ever take this ring off again.
That is just so awesome right there. You know, that's the stuff movies are made out of. So from that point, okay, so you got your ring back. He kept his promise, and you got the ring back. So take us from that point until you, from the storefront, now you're on North Avenue. So what
was the... In 1988, we moved into a firehouse, a surplus firehouse on North Avenue. And again, Elmer's philosophy, community development and cultural development go hand in hand. Elmer's belief that conventional wisdom all over this nation is that you hide your poverty areas. And once you succeed in hiding them, then you can succeed in neglecting them. But that we were going to create a museum so compelling that people were from all over the world were going to come to visit. And and so we are in the heart of a challenged community. We started purchasing the buildings on the block because Elmer's dream of a block-long museum where we brought jobs and revitalization to that area and to show that an African-American institution could do that. Elmer said some of our institutions have to be willing to stay in our communities and make those communities better, that we all can't run away because our communities and the children who need us, they shouldn't have to go out of their communities to believe that that's right. where all of the good stuff is. They should be able to know that right there in the heart of their communities are things worth having and knowing and seeing. And so that's why we're there and, you know, working very hard to make that part of the dream a reality of creating this block-long museum. We have a beautiful design and want to change and believe that we can change the face of North Avenue.
Well, you've done that. You've already done that just with your presence because, my goodness, like I said, if you haven't gone to the museum, ladies and gentlemen, you need to make a trip. And one of the things that amazed me when I started working with you is the visitorship, the numbers. And I'm not talking just from our city. I'm talking from around the world. Buses lined up from one end of North Avenue where you are down to the other end. And it was just, it's a beautiful thing to see. And for me, Dr. Martin, you know, seeing, I want you to talk about your children. And when I say children, you got a whole lot of them that you have mentored and helped to get into schools and that you have taught and you continue to. So let's talk a little bit about your youth programs.
What we try to do is to show kids that they're not all going to be rap stars and athletes and so forth, that they have to prepare for another lifestyle and another life. And so to have the kids, I remember walking through and they were having a meeting and one of them was saying that they were going to be the president of National Great Blacks and Wax Museum like Dr. Elmer Martin, and one of them had decided they were going to have my role, and one of them was saying, well, I'm going to business school and I'm going to come back to run the gift shop. And, you know, so these kids came in with a traditional, I'm going to make a lot of money, I don't know how, And here they were mapping out a future that was very non-traditional for the way the kids
right.
think. So that
right.
has been good, except that Elma said, Joe, we got to watch our back because they're trying to replace us. but so having them think like that, we've got kids who were 10 years old, and one of them is William Redmond, who
mm-hmm.
was 10 years old when he came to the museum. And I, when Elmer and I went to Egypt, the idea was that we were going to come back to, and it would be business as usual. And Elmer died in Egypt, as you know. And so for me, just looking at the continuity of the museum, and when I think about that, I can think of no one better than William Redmond to run the museum
mm-hmm.
when I'm no longer able to do that. He's
wow.
all of 26, 27 now, and he started when he was 10. I keep him apprised of what's going on, but, you know, just trying to think succession plan and all of that and what's going to happen when either when I'm no longer here or when I'm no longer able to do what I do. I'm constantly looking at how to involve young people in that way so that they
yeah.
feel a sense of the need to carry this museum on and helping them to understand that that has to be their responsibility, that I can
and
take
you know,
it only so far.
Yeah, and, you know, I've witnessed kids coming in on their tours and their eyes just, you know, open so wide with amazement and them listening to the curators, you know, talking about the exhibits and the things that they themselves, of course, didn't know because of, you know, I know when I was a kid, I wasn't taught a lot of that stuff in my in history class. They weren't teaching us that kind of stuff. So when you walk through the museum, you literally get an excellent, excellent experience. And I want you to talk about the guest that you had recently, who is now a famous actress in
right.
One of the movies that got, you know, that's getting all kinds of acclamations and awards. So I want you to talk about that and you know, tell me how that came about.
And you mentioned the youth also that a part of the experience is that we train those youth to be tour guides. And
exactly.
so I'm very proud of that. But you're talking about Lupita Nyong'o from 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
She wrote in a number of articles. She was asked how did she prepare for her character of Patsy, and she said one of the main things she did was to make a visit to the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum in Baltimore. That
That's
a friend
amazing.
Of hers had told her that that's what you need to do. And she said he was so insistent that she just knew she had to take his advice. And when she came in, she knew that she was at the right place because the first thing that she saw was this 500-pound bale of cotton.
Right.
And, you know, the cotton was so key to her role. And she was saying that she had no frame of reference prior to coming to the museum of what a 500-pound bale of cotton was. And that was the standard that was being used in the movie. So to come in and see that cotton and see that it was how much taller it was and wider than it was than she. And then to be able to go down into the hold of the slave ship and see the captives shackled and to be
yeah.
able to, she talked about the polar bear and polar exploration with Matthew Henson and all of
right.
the many, many things that she learned that she simply did not know and what pride she had in walking
yeah.
out of the museum taking into account what she had learned, but also a sense of what that role meant.
Yeah. Yeah, I get goosebumps just listening to you talk about it. And I've been through there, you know, hundreds of times myself. But it never gets old because it's like when you go through, you're always seeing something new, something that you didn't see before. And
exactly.
I don't know where it comes
exactly.
from, but it just seems like it's popped up. It's like, wait a minute, was that there before? You know, and you're like, yeah, that's always been here. But I'm excited to talk about a little bit the expansion because you're going through a 25,000-square-foot expansion. And ladies and gentlemen, if you look at the if you're listening to the show online and you see the picture scrolling across the page, I have a picture up of what the expansion is going to look like. So, Dr. Martin, if you can just talk a little bit about your expansion and some of the new exhibits that you are planning to put out there for us.
Well, we right now we tell 5,000 years of history, and with the expansion, it is our intention to tell 250,000 years of history, starting in Africa, where mankind stepped out onto the earth in Africa and spread throughout the world in forming what came to be known as the races, but all of us from that very same source. And so that will be the beginning. What some people refer to as the biblical Eve. Again, all of us having that biblical Eve within us. And then looking at categories of history. So sports, we're getting ready to launch our spirituality and religion project. We did four figures of four educators for Uplift as a part of our gallery of education, history and philosophy, I think it's called, or our gallery of spirituality and religion, gallery of sports, athletics, and recreation. So, you know, looking at those categories of history and all of the ways that we have contributed to each of those, and having education space so that we can do more teaching, which is primary to our mission. Of course, creating business incubators right there so that the tourism that we've shown can exist in our community, where people come into this area specifically for Great Blacks and Wax, that there are jobs and businesses and opportunity and hope in our community.
Yeah, because when I say they, I'm talking about the city. Actually, I had asked you all to move towards downtown at one point. Am I right?
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. We decided that, again, Elmer's philosophy that some of our institutions have to be willing to stay in our communities, that to build those communities, to make them stronger, to give our kids a reason to see beauty in their communities and opportunity in their communities. That we couldn't do that but if we so easily went to the Inner Harbor, which is where we were being encouraged to go.
Right, to go. Right.
And when you look at we've got a slave ship, and we've got the exhibit, The Struggle Against Lynching, Lessons for Today, that we, you know, the harbor, people come to the harbor, and they're lighthearted and whatever, and to grasp the seriousness of the exhibit. We want you, people leave out of the museum and saying that they felt inspired, but you have to work through the pain of our history. You have to work through the triumph of our history. And I don't know that you come with the right attitude down in the harbor and the willingness to grasp all of that and work your way through all of that. And so for that reason, but more than anything else, to be in that community and show that tourism can thrive in our community and that we can create jobs and opportunity and be an economic engine in that community.
And thrive it has. And, you know, you bring up another good point, Dr. Martin, and I want you to kind of talk just a little bit about our children, because I remember hearing some people say, you know, well, maybe the lynching exhibit, for example, may be a bit too much for our children, or the slave ship exhibit may be a little bit too much for our children. But I found that, you know, this is my belief, but I believe that they need to know that, you know,
exactly,
in order to move forward, so we don't repeat the same mistakes. And I know myself, you know, I've had, you know, talked to some of the kids that were, you know, taking tours and things, and they had questions, or they were like, had the look of horror on their faces, and because they just didn't know. So So you know, I know that you've, of course, seen so many But talk about some of the negative comments that you may have gotten from people feeling that it was just a bit too much.
Well, I remember that a school took us off the field trip list, one of the county schools. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that was a nightmare for us because they didn't say anything. And we started getting these calls from teachers, saying, you know, we brought our kids here. One teacher said, I brought my kids here for the past 7 years. And we went to a faculty meeting, and then they told us that Great Blacks and Whites wasn't on the list. I had a teacher, a young white teacher, who bucked the school system and brought her kids to our museum. And mm-hmm. But one of the things that stands out for me is that, well, two things, really. A news reporter from one of the stations in Washington, D.C. called, and they wanted to come in and look at this controversy of our being taken off the field trip list. And mm-hmm. so she called and wanted to know when we would have a predominantly white audience at the museum. And so my staff was upset, but I gave her the time. So she came in with the camera crew, and the kids went, and 70% of them were young white kids, and they went into the slave ship, and they came back out, and the reporter asked the little girl, tell me about the slave ship, how did you feel about the slave ship? And the little girl said, it scared me. And I said, oh, God, it's all over now. But the reporter was so astute, and she said, what scared you about it? And the little girl said that human beings would treat one another that way.
Oh, right.
And so, you know, adults are hearing, it scared me. Kids are saying that human beings would treat one another that way.
Yes. And, you know, specifically I remember it was an elementary class, school class that came through, and they were down in the lynching exhibit, and these two little girls were holding each other's hands, and they had tears coming down their face, and I pulled them to the side and asked them the same question. And their answer was they couldn't understand why people would treat each other like that. Who would do that?
Exactly.
You know,
it's that kind of thing where we need out of the mouths of babes, you know, that we need to hear our children and what we want them to think they're saying, perhaps not. I had a young Japanese American student. She came in with them, and there were this group of. It was when we first opened our lynching exhibit, and so she came. The African American students were down there, and they heard me conducting an interview with someone, and so they knew I was involved in the museum in some way. And they came over to me when the reporter left, and they said, "We heard you talking about this, and you said something about your uncle said that all black people got a lynching story." And they said, "We don't have a lynching story because we didn't know that there was such a thing as lynching."
Right.
This was 1997. These were teenagers. They'd never heard of lynching. We started talking about that, and they asked some questions, and they left. Then the Japanese-American student, she came up to me. She said, "I heard what my classmates were saying about not knowing about lynching." And she said, "And I didn't know anything about it either, but there's something that's troubling me, and it's a little bit more personal to my history." And I said, "Well, let's talk about that." And she said, "I just found out about Japanese-American internment during World War II.
Right.
And she said, and I've been so upset ever since. She said, I've just been devastated because no one talked to me about that. She said, my grandmother, who's always talking about history and the old country and whatever, and being a Nisei or whatever, she never mentioned this. My mother and father never mentioned this, textbooks, not my teachers. And so I listened to my African-American students talking about this important part of their history that they know nothing about. And I know the agony I'm going through about this part of my history that I know nothing about. And I ask myself, who makes these decisions about what history gets told and not told?
Yes. And you know, Dr. Martin, I've heard, I don't know, you've probably heard this because you're Dr. Martin, but, you know, they're trying to even take more history out of the books.
Yes.
You know, and just before you know it, they're just going to wipe it all away. So
exactly.
This museum is so just imperative and important to the world. Because there's nothing, to me, there's nothing on the face of the planet like it, nothing. We have, you know, the Jewish community have their Holocaust Museum, which is also awesome in its own right, but they've always told their history. They've never run away, as far as I know, from their history.
Right, exactly.
And
no,
I remember, yeah, and I remember one time we went through again, and you just amazed me. I mean, you just always amaze me. But one of the things, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a time we went through, and we were in the, I call it the African room, with the paintings and the Shaka Zulu. And it was a group of teenagers. And you know how teenage boys can be. You know, and they were, well, as you were speaking and your back was turned, one of them said they were laughing at how black Shaka Zulu was.
Mm-hmm.
And they made a comment, and you stopped mid-sentence, and you turned
mm-hmm.
around, and you said, and what is wrong with him being black? Or so, and then he looked at you like a deer, you know, he had this expression on his face like a deer caught in headlights. But you broke that thing down to him
mm-hmm.
so eloquently. That you, I mean, he got a history lesson that was not even on the books, you know, but that's how the museum draws. It draws people's fears out, and you just spoke to him about our skin color and, you know, what it means and the pride, you know, of that. And I bet you when you finished with him, he was just a whole different person throughout the rest of that tour.
I'm sorry. Then that's what I always hope for. That you know, we get them to think differently about certain things, and it's so important. And for us not to pull back and be afraid to talk to our children.
Yes, Dr. Martin. And so tell, you know, I have a lot of people who, like I said, listen to the show and, you know, to be inspired and encouraged. So, you know, what advice or what could you, because you've been through a lot, I mean, holding down the fort and holding down something like this, especially after your husband has passed on, you know, there's a lot of challenges that come, but you face each and every one of them, and you always come through it. But what advice or encouragement could you give to the listening audience who are trying to build their own businesses? You know, what could you say to them to help them to just hold on and keep moving?
Well, you know, education is important, and business education is important. And I'm not saying go back to school and look for, to get a degree or anything like that, but in looking at some of the things that I learned early on, we came into the tourism industry, and I didn't know anything about what the tourism industry is. I could do presentations now on that, but I went to workshops, and I listened, and I learned, and there are any number of things. I didn't. Elmer was the historian in the family. I learned so much from him, but also just being willing to learn a lot about the history, using what I know, the teacher in me, because that's first and foremost is what I am and what I always hope to be. So looking at who I am and what I bring to this, not trying to be Elmer Martin, but just trying to be who I am and know that I bring something important to this. But also being able to look at the ground floor and work my way up in terms of learning what do they mean by the tourism industry. What are they talking about when they talk about demographics and all of those things that I have learned. What does it mean? Who is your audience in the spring? And how do you market to that audience when it's a spring break audience that's coming from different parts of the country and farther distances versus that audience that is coming in the summer versus that audience that goes away in September, and what do you do then? So knowing your market and the marketplace, and knowing who you are and what unique things you bring, and making some decisions just based on that.
And you still, if I'm not mistaken, attend workshops every now and then?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
every chance I get. And I read a lot on my iPhone. You come in the
iPhone. Congratulations. wait a minute. Let me do this, because we got to do this properly now. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Martin has an iPhone. Let's give her a big old round of applause. I'm so proud of you. And the reason why, and ladies, I know you, they're probably wondering what, but there was one point when Dr. Martin just would not touch a computer. She would not, the cell phone was just, no, I'm just not getting a cell phone. And so she started off, you know, I think you had a BlackBerry at first, didn't you?
I had a BlackBerry. Love my BlackBerry.
And then she graduated to the iPhone. So I just salute you, Dr. Martin. And see, and ladies and gentlemen, that's what, you know, you have to stay on top of things, because the world continues to evolve. We're always changing. Technology changes. And if you have a business, you've got to stay on top of things, right?
Absolutely. And one of the things I pointed out to the staff when they wanted me to, because I didn't learn to type, and so that was the drawback, because nobody would. I sit at the computer, and I'm saying, well, where is Y on here? And people get so, you know, so impatient with me. But I told them, I don't know, I'm not going to get to this computer, but I know what this computer will do. And so I was always saying, you know, well, so-and-so, can't you do this? Can't we create this document? And so they were always amazed that I had a sense of what we should be able to do with the computer, even though I wasn't going to do it myself.
Right.
but there was just a wealth of information. I read what comes on my iPhone about sessions that are taking place, looking at other people's calendars of events, what kind of activities they are having, what's going on around the world. So, you know, it's not where you get something and you just delete it. I'm going through that information is coming on my iPhone, and I'm learning. And constantly trying to make sure that every vehicle, every vessel that can serve as a tool for me for learning, and that's how I use it.
And you just are amazing, because I'm telling you, it just amazes me how much it takes a lot of work to keep a place of that magnitude open. And tell us a little bit, because the time is winding down, but I want you to just briefly talk about the expansion. You know, where are you with it? What is the date, you know, the finish date? What do you need? So now you have a listening audience out there. Talk to them and tell them what you now need, what you're looking for, and all that good stuff.
Well, we need people to go online. We're about to we're building the site to dedicate it directly to the expansion, and so there'll be a number of donor opportunities. Whether it's buying a brick for the we have a rooftop garden and all kinds of places where you can have your personalized brick, or whether it's naming a space, a gallery, whether you're an organization that wants to fund a wax figure, whether you want to contribute to an endowment or membership, all of the different ways that you can support this whole effort for us to expand and create this block-long museum. You can certainly, I know your listeners are from all over the world, but when they're in this country, just hook a left from D.C. and come to Baltimore and see the museum. And just support us in that way, and go on our website and stay, you know, tuned to what's going on, all of those things.
And you have a famous designer, an architect, not mistaken. Mm-hmm.
Yes, our designer, initial designer was Max Bond, who very well known around the world. And if you look at African-American designers, you're going to find Max Bond's name. Max died before he really got into he carried this project so long. He contracted cancer, and he died suddenly.
Oh.
But he had, his mentee was Peter Cook. When you see Rocky running up the steps in the movie, that's the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and the architect was someone named Julian Abel, and Julian Abel was the grand uncle of our own Peter Cook, and so Peter comes with a legacy, and then we have a very talented architect assisting Peter, and his name is Rob Anderson, and they've created this very groundbreaking design, and I understand you've shown it to people. So just, you know, we're just very, very proud of our design and what it will do for that area of Baltimore City.
Yeah, because the area, that corridor is already developing so beautifully. I mean, you have Johns Hopkins coming up from the back, and it's just amazing. The transformation that's already going on down there
exactly.
is just amazing.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
So when are you looking for, do you have a date?
We are looking at 2017.
Okay, 2017. That's just right around the corner, Dr. Martin.
Yes,
how do you
is.
Feel about
yes,
that?
It is. Feel very good. We were held up for a while with some preservationists, so we had to work on some things. But we've done that, and so we're ready to move forward now.
And see, this
and
is
I'm,
the thing
I'm proud of our
about.
Exhibits as well. I'm sorry.
Your exhibits. You have new exhibits.
The designer we have a designer for our exhibits.
Okay.
I work very, very closely with them. I'm the one guiding the process, and our mm-hmm. exhibits are just so groundbreaking. I just feel that when we do this, there will be nothing like it. There just won't. And the story. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I can't wait. I just can't wait. I'm so excited. So this is absolutely wonderful. So, ladies and gentlemen, please, once again, if you have not, make sure you put this on your bucket list when you come make a special trip to Baltimore, Maryland, and go on over to the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum. Tell them that you've heard about it through my show, A Date with Destiny, and ask to speak with Dr. Martin. She'll come out and shake your hand. I mean, she'll love to meet people.
Absolutely.
And on their website, visit their website, National Great Blacks and Wax. I believe it's .org, Dr. Martin?
.org, yes.
Is it .org? Okay. And they're going to have a link where you can click on that, and they'll have several things where you can donate, because they're still, you know, it's a great undertaking. They're still looking for donations and so on and so forth. So just please go visit their website and see where you can just, and I guarantee you, you know, you will just feel good about it, because, again, the place is just amazing. And it's not just for African Americans. It's for the world. It's for all of us. Just to learn. And so, Dr. Martin, I just want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing. Now, is there any last words that you want to give out before we just bring this thing to a close?
Well, I want to thank you again, Lisa, for having me on your show. This was it was conversational, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, well, thank you, and we got to get together. We keep saying we got to get together and do lunch, but we really, really do, Dr. Martin.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
If I have to come by and pick you up myself.
Well, that will work. That works.
That will work. All right. Well, please tell everyone at the museum I said hello and send them my love. And once again, I thank you. And once the museum is getting closer and closer to that date, we want to bring you back and just have another conversation about the beautiful things that you're doing over there.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
You too.
All right. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, that was Dr. Joanne Mitchell-Martin from the National Great Blacks and Wax Museum in Baltimore, Maryland. I just want to thank her so much for coming on and sharing with us, because, as we know, knowledge is power, and when we know better, we do better. That is my motto. I love that. When we know better, we do better. I want to thank everyone for tuning in with us. A shout-out to my family who are always loving and supporting me, and also to my friends and colleagues in all of my social networking sites. Also, don't forget to stop by my website, yourdestinyawaits.net, to get some extra motivation and inspiration. And like us on Facebook at facebook.com/adatewithdestiny101. Twitter, LYSE101, that's LYSE101. We will be back on Monday, March 3rd at 5:30 Eastern Standard Time. So your mission, ladies and gentlemen, if you choose to accept it, is take the necessary time to do a true self-evaluation, seek God, and learn how to love yourself first, because after all, you owe it to yourself to know yourself. Once again, I'm Lisa M. Saunders, and thank you for tuning in to Blog Talk Radio's A Date with Destiny. Peace and abundant blessings, everyone. ¶¶